I got a question for you. 1968, one of the best years I ever had, or any pitcher ever had. And I was on top of my game. I knew exactly what I was doing and when I was doing it. I decided to lower the mound 5 inches. Was that legal?
Well, it was legal because they made it.
So what did it do
now,
to the records?
What about the records? They lowered the mound 5 inches. And so all of a sudden, the pitchers don't have an advantage, and they did it, and it was a legal thing to do. Now, I don't think it was illegal.
I might add that Bob accepted that very graciously.
I'm still mad about it.
You know, Denny McClain won 31 that year. You had an ERA of 1.12. They said Carl Yastrzemski led the American League in hitting with 301. They said enough is enough. You know, we gotta put some balance back.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm thinking that whatever happened after 1968 shouldn't be legal.
Baseball history ends with Bob Gibson's MVP and Cy Young season.
Cardinal legend Bob Gibson on Bob Costas' HBO show last week, part of a roundtable with Tim McCarver and Joe Morgan and Bob Costas talking about steroids and baseball. And Bob Costas joins me here this afternoon on KMOX. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
I'm doing just great. That was a terrific show you did last week, and I particularly liked Willie Mays and Mike Schmidt in there as well. But the one thing I got to ask you about is Jose Canseco.
Mm-hmm.
Who you also included in the show, and you were talking about Barry Bonds, and you were talking about steroids and, you know, the Bash Brothers in the late 80s. Has your impression of Canseco changed since everything he said seems to have been right?
Yeah. I suspected when his book first came out, or not suspected, believed when his book first came out, that in general what he was saying was true, because I'd been talking about steroids being a significant problem in baseball for at least a decade. What I didn't know for sure was whether every specific allegation was true. But this was before guys were dragged before Congress. And clearly, although I have very favorable personal feelings toward Mark McGwire, if the essence of what Canseco said had been untrue, then Mark would have taken an entirely different approach in his testimony or non-testimony. And if what he said about Rafael Palmeiro was essentially untrue, it's hard to believe that Palmeiro would then have tested positive and have used steroids for the very first time in his life, only immediately after telling Congress and the world that he had never done it under any circumstances. So, you know, I thought Canseco's general credibility was high in terms of the general assessment of steroid use in baseball. I thought he might have overstated it a bit, but that the general point was correct. And now on particulars, I think his credibility is even greater.
And we're in the midst of a week in which Barry Bonds could catch Babe Ruth and perhaps pass him as the greatest left-handed home run hitter of all time, then going number two on the list to Hank Aaron. Do you think there should be an asterisk next to Barry's name in the record books?
Well, as Tim McCarver said on the show and other people have said, knowledgeable baseball fans already have a figurative asterisk after the entire era. Steve Hurt, who was with the Elias Sports Bureau, the official record keepers for baseball, made a very interesting point recently. He said, you know, we got to stop thinking that the most means the best. Barry Bonds was a great, great player even before he obviously began juicing in the late 1990s. If he had retired in 1998, he'd be a first ballot Hall of Famer and, in my opinion, probably one of the 10 best all-round players in baseball history. But everything that he's done in the last 5 or 6 years is to a substantial extent inauthentic. So even though he'll have more lifetime homers than Ruth, that doesn't mean he's greater than Ruth. As it is, even with the artificial enhancers, it's taken him more than 1,000 extra at-bats to hit the same number of homers as Babe Ruth. Granted, they played in different circumstances. So I would say that Ruth, in the context of his time, is still a greater player than Barry Bonds.
And Hank Aaron better than both of them?
Well, you know, Aaron had 4,000 more at-bats in order to hit 41 more home runs than Babe Ruth. Hank Aaron is a completely admirable player and an even more admirable man, and he's a great, great player. It's a little bit of apples and oranges to compare him to Ruth. Ruth led the league in homers 12 times. He had a lifetime slugging average of .690. When he retired, he had more than 200 homers, more than the second guy on the list, Jimmy Fox. So Ruth towered over his era to an even greater extent than Aaron did over his, but it was a segregated era, and the game had not evolved in terms of every nuance between 1927, let's say, and 1974. So it's hard to rank them, but I couldn't rank Aaron ahead of Ruth. I can't rank anybody ahead of Ruth in the context of his time.
You mentioned segregation. There is talk that all of this talk against Barry Bonds now is racial. One of the columnists for the Post-Dispatch had a piece either today or yesterday saying, you know, Barry's trying to make himself the O.J. of baseball, or he is the O.J. of baseball, especially when compared to Hank Aaron and everything that he went through in 1974. You think that's true?
I do. It was Brian Burwell's column. I thought it was an excellent column. Brian is, as most people know, an African-American columnist. He doesn't shy away from legitimate racial issues. Racism is a very serious issue, and when it has truth, it's a very serious charge. But what we see increasingly in public life is that people use a bogus charge of racism as a red herring to deflect attention from the real issue. The real issue here is not Barry Bonds' race, it's Barry Bonds' behavior, specifically as it regards performance-enhancing drugs. Hank Aaron is the record holder, not Babe Ruth, all right? Hank Aaron, a great African-American ballplayer, is the record holder. He is rightly admired both as a player and as a man because of the way he conducted himself. That same sort of admiration does not come to Barry Bonds, not because of skin color, but because of legitimate distinctions between the individuals. Put it another way, if Ken Griffey Jr. now had 713 home runs, a person who's never been suspected of using performance-enhancing drugs and whose general personality and demeanor is very pleasant and fan-friendly, the whole world would love Ken Griffey Jr. And if we knew now what we think we know about Mark McGwire in 1998, and if Mark McGwire were still an active player and he had 713 home runs, there would be a tremendous amount of skepticism about Mark McGwire. None of it would have to do with skin color. It would have to do with the evidence and the facts of the matter. And that's what Barry Bonds, as Brian Burwell said, will eventually have to deal with. The truth and the evidence will overtake any bogus arguments of racism in this case.
What I would like to see as a positive thing out of this is for people to go back and learn exactly what it was that Hank Aaron had to overcome in 1974. Sandy Tolan wrote a terrific book called Me and Hank about correspondence he had with him and talks about...
I read it.
I mean, it's a wonderful book about the unbelievable racism and hatred that this man had to put up with and still perform so brilliantly at 20 years into his career.
And because of the actions and the dignity and decency of people like Hank Aaron, and because of the passage of time and the attitudes that he had to face, either those people dying out and being replaced by our generation and subsequent generations, or because people learn, whatever it may be, those attitudes, by and large, have been reduced and consigned to the shadows. Is there still racism? Of course there is. Are there still virulent racists out there that make up some fraction of society? Of course there are, and it's still a problem, and it's still something that we have to be aware of. But that doesn't mean that every time someone makes a claim of racism, that that claim is legitimate. And in Barry Bonds' case, although there may be some racists out there who don't like him, that doesn't account for the 90% or more of people who have doubts about Barry Bonds that has nothing to do with race. If they thought that his performance was legit, they would stand and cheer him black or white.
Bob, you know the two guys from the San Francisco Chronicle, Mark Federawatta and Lance Williams, who've been on this show. They wrote the book Game of Shadows and have been uncovering all this stuff about Balco and Barry Bonds and all the rest. They've been called to testify before the grand jury, and they say they won't give up their sources and all that sort of stuff. This issue is not going to be going away anytime soon. Do you think that Major League Baseball has handled it well and will handle it better? Do you think the Players Union has handled it well and will handle it better? And do you think players are still juicing? I know that's five questions, but I know you can handle them.
Well, as we said in the show, it's pretty clear the players are still juicing. There are designer steroids. That was the whole point of Balco, to create steroids that could evade the test. There are also substances like human growth hormone, for which there are no legitimate tests at this time. So sophisticated players who are willing to take a little bit of a chance and hook up with the right people who know how to do it can still be juicing and won't be detected. And it's very apparent to me that while the numbers have been reduced and while the culture around the game has changed and there's less approval and less tolerance of drug use, I think there are still a substantial number of players juicing. Both the owners and players, to answer your other question, owners and players association, were shamefully slow in coming to grips with the issue, but the owners eventually did, and the Players Association's leaders maintained their obstructionist stance until Congress got into the act and threatened them. And the combination of Canseco's book, the Balco investigation, and especially Congress, finally got even the super stubborn leaders of the Players Association to make some concessions. So now baseball has a much better policy in terms of testing and punishment than it did before. And I think the Mitchell investigation is a hopeful sign. I hope they don't overstep their bounds and trample all over everyone's civil liberties. But I think the idea of trying to get a handle on this and issue some kind of ruling about it is a good idea. So I think that baseball gets passing grades now, but failing grades in the recent past.
All right, we've been concentrating on something you did on HBO last week. Let's talk about what you're going to be doing on NBC in a few months when, once again, you're in the booth doing football, and you'll have Al Michaels and John Madden out at the stadiums doing the play-by-play for Sunday Night Football. Before they were signed, did you consider doing play-by-play again?
Well, I would have if it was NBC's last resort, but I didn't want to. I think I could have done it, and I would have enjoyed it, but at this stage of my life and career, I don't want to be traipsing all around the country any more than I have to. I wanted a schedule that made sense and had me on a track between St. Louis and New York, and by doing a studio show Sunday nights from New York and coupling that with my HBO work, most of which is in New York as well, that's a saner schedule than being in Green Bay one week and the next, especially when those Sunday nights, many of them are in November and December, and you're freezing your tail off, wondering whether the hotel has 24-hour room service and whether that includes a hot water bottle when you get back to your room at 1 o'clock in the morning. So call me a wimp if you want, but I like the cozy studio.
No, I think you invoked veterans' privilege there.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Plus, if they could get Al Michaels, I said all along, look, if you can get Al Michaels, then you'll have the strongest possible lineup if you have me in the studio and him in the booth. And with Al and John Madden and Chris Collinsworth joining me in the studio show, I think we got a pretty good lineup.
I heard they were grooming Collinsworth as a play-by-play guy if they couldn't get Al and John. Is that true?
Yeah, they did some practice games with Collinsworth and John Madden. And Chris is an extremely talented guy, and I'm sure he could do anything, but he has no play-by-play experience. So really, I think we're much better off where we wound up.
Who else is going to be in the studio with you?
Jerome Bettis, newly retired from the Super Bowl champion Steelers and always a fan favorite. He'll be there. And Sterling Sharp as well.
Oh, that's going to be great.
I hope so.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
I don't mess it up. It should be good.
Well, I don't think there's a very, very big chance of that. I mean, you're the pro. You're the pro from Dover, as they said in the movie MASH. I had Christine Brennan on the show yesterday, the great sports writer. She's got a wonderful new book out. And last time I had her on was from Torino, where you, of course, were also covering the Olympics. I asked her if the Olympics are in trouble because of things like the internet and the immediacy of information in the 21st century, and you're hosting the primetime stuff for NBC's Olympics, and you have for so long. What do you think, as the guy who has to anchor that stuff, to know that Sasha Cohen isn't coming up until 3 hours from now, even though everybody knows that she fell this afternoon?
Right. Well, you know, I've always said, all you can do is play the hand you're dealt. When you're in Atlanta and it's live in 96 or Salt Lake City in 2002 and it's either live or on a very short tape turnaround, that's a better hand than having to show something on tape delay from Athens or from Torino, especially this time around, because Americans generally don't do as well in the Winter Olympics as they do in the Summer Olympics. And for the first time that we've done an Olympics, NBC is not the number one network anymore. We're the number four network, at least temporarily, in the ratings. So we weren't preempting our own number one shows. We were preempting our third-ranked or fourth-ranked shows and going up against blockbusters like American Idol and Grey's Anatomy and Desperate Housewives. And so while we still got a very, very large audience, it just wasn't as large proportionately as past Olympic audiences. NBC still made a profit on it. It was still a worthwhile thing to do. And I know that we'll bounce back ratings-wise in China in the summer of 08, when the time difference is so great that we can actually show a lot of events live in American prime time, because it'll be late morning or early afternoon the next day in Beijing. And then the following Winter Olympics is in 2010 in Vancouver, So essentially that's the Pacific time zone. And again, we'll be live or close to live. So the ratings will rebound, and by then probably many of those shows on the other networks will have faded in popularity a bit, and NBC might be on the rebound. And the same quality of coverage will all of a sudden look a whole lot better when the ratings are correspondingly high.
Yeah.
You know, the example I always give would be this. I'm sure the ratings of last year's World Series, which was a four-game sweep between the White Sox and the Astros, as great a job as Joe Buck and Tim McCarver always do on Fox, that's a relatively low-rated World Series.
Yeah.
Now, if this year the Yankees play the Dodgers or the Yankees play the Cubs in the World Series, same broadcasters, same producers, same director, same excellent telecast, and the ratings will double. Joe and Tim won't be any better. They're great all the time. But the circumstances will be different.
Yeah,
plus, and that's what it is each time with the Olympics.
Plus, if I do my math right, after you do two more Olympics, you'll be able to invoke veterans privilege there and say, I'm not going anywhere. I'll anchor it from New York.
Or St. Louis.
Or St. Louis. There you go. By the way, Bob is going to be here in St. Louis hosting the National Sportsmanship Awards on Saturday, June 10th at the Chase. What is that?
Well, it's put on by the St. Louis Sports Commission. And obviously pays tribute to what some people think is a disappearing trait in American sports, which is the idea of sportsmanship. But they have one of the best examples of it, the Olympic speed skater Joey Cheek, who gave his bonus money for winning a gold medal to Johan Olev Kass's worldwide organization. It's kind of a sporting version of the Peace Corps that travels around the globe and tries to use sports to help people in underprivileged areas. He's just a tremendous example of what sports and a larger perspective can be. And so Joey Cheek is one of the people who'll be there, and I think part of what they have me doing is interviewing Joey Cheek.
All right, that'll be on Saturday night, June 10th at the Chase. For tickets, you call 992-0686 or go to stlsports.org. So I got to wait three more weeks before your next show, huh?
Actually, we have changed the show because of my additional NBC duties. The show now, Costas Now, instead of being monthly, will be quarterly. And so you got to wait till September.
You're killing me, Bob.
September. But think of it this way. It'll seem all the more special.
All right. Then I'll talk to you around Labor Day.
Anticipation. That's right. That's right.
There you go. Thanks, Bob. Always a pleasure.
Paul, thank you. Good talking to you.
Bob Costas here on the Paul Harris Show. It's News Talk 1120 KMOX.